This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One of the key differences between us and these other markets is that in our marketplace, it will be very clear to all parties involved that every single certificate represents one actual ton of CO2 removed, and that will be an auditable and traceable transaction.
If you ask most people what they think of blockchain applications or cryptocurrency, the response is usually a blank stare of utter bafflement. Well, this week on Sea Change Radio, we're going to try to make some sense of this arcane concept as we revisit our 2018 discussion with Paul Gamble, an entrepreneur who's devised a carbon dioxide removal marketplace, which incorporates blockchain applications. Gamble explains how his startup Nori uses this cryptography-based technology, how it plans to ramp up into a vibrant marketplace of buyers and sellers, and why he believes this could actually help reverse the effects of climate change. Then we speak to Jackie Francis, the executive director of the Keeling Curve Prize, as she tells us about her organization's mission and gives us a glimpse at some of the 2019 winners. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Paul Gamble. He's the CEO and co-founder of Nori. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
I wanted to have you on because you founded this very interesting platform called Nori, which is not just trying to reduce carbon in the atmosphere, but trying to remove it. And you have an event coming up later this week, April 26th and 27th in Seattle, called Reversapalooza. So first, why don't you tell us, before we get into the details of Reversapalooza, why don't you explain the concept of Nori for our listeners?
Okay, sure. So Nori is a company with the philosophy that we're interested in not just making climate change and its effects less bad, but we're interested in undoing it and really trying to reverse climate change as much as we can. And that's where we get into the notion of carbon removal. So it's sort of simple arithmetic. We've put a lot of greenhouse gases up in the atmosphere ever since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And we are trying to incentivize different ways to pull those back out and store them somewhere in a very permanent fashion.
And it uses blockchain technology, which a lot of people have heard about but don't necessarily understand. It dates back to the first cryptocurrencies. Why don't you explain how the concept of blockchains are an integral part of the Nori platform?
Sure. So there are really kind of two sides to blockchains. People probably have also heard the term cryptocurrency, and they're not exactly the same thing, but they both serve a purpose with Nori. So a blockchain is really just a distributed ledger of transactions. And it's you can think of it like a shared database where everyone who is participating in the network, which is open to anyone at all times, has a copy of every single record that's existed and taken place on it. And what Nori is doing is we are taking the actions that what we call in our marketplace suppliers. So these are people who are removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through any number of different methods. And we can talk about that later if you'd like. They are removing that. And then Nori does the work of measuring and verifying that carbon dioxide is removed through independent third-party verifiers. And when that happens, what's created for them on the blockchain is a certificate that we call the carbon removal certificate. And each certificate represents one ton of CO2, that's a metric ton of CO2 equivalent removed from the atmosphere and stored. Now, those certificates are going to eventually transfer ownership from the supplier to whoever ends up purchasing these certificates. We call those buyers in our marketplace. That ownership change and the transaction that enables that happens on the blockchain, so that after a buyer who might be, say, a large corporation who wants to offset their the carbon emissions in their supply chain. After the buyer purchases those certificates, the record of them owning it and the record of what was actually done to remove the carbon dioxide, how it was measured, and making that data available to be audited by anyone, that's all open and completely transparent on the blockchain in a permanent record, so that there's nothing anyone can do to corrupt that or cheat the system. Once that data is on the blockchain, it's there and it's immutable. So the blockchain provides us this very open and transparent method of recording all the things that happen, because it's really important. Carbon dioxide is an invisible and odorless gas. We can't observe it. And so we have to take these other measures to verify that it's been removed and stored, and then make that information available. So that's the blockchain side of things. And then there's the cryptocurrency side of things, which is more on the financial aspect of this. And what we're doing is we are creating our own cryptocurrency that'll be called the Nori token. And when a buyer wants to purchase a carbon removal certificate, they will pay one token for every ton of CO2 that gets removed. And that exchange rate will always be the same. So that means that whatever price the buyer pays for the Nori tokens in dollars is the price that they end up paying for that carbon dioxide removed. And what that means is whatever price that token is trading at in the third-party cryptocurrency markets is now a universal market-driven price on carbon removal, which is something that's never existed before. And economists for decades have been saying this is what we need in order to make some measurable progress on turning the tide with global warming and climate change. So I'm really, really excited about that part.
Oh, it's a fascinating idea. Who is the target market for the platform? How would large corporations, the biggest polluters on the planet, or governments access the platform?
Yeah, so throughout sort of different stages in our roadmap, we are going to be targeting different groups of potential buyers. To start with, it's these large corporations who are already doing this sort of thing. There are many corporations who aren't under any sort of regulatory requirement to purchase these, but they're doing so voluntarily because their customers are demanding it, or their shareholders are demanding it, or maybe a trade group they're a member of is demanding it. They're buying these in large amounts. They're often buying these from the existing marketplaces. There are voluntary marketplaces and compliance marketplaces, and they're buying offset credits is what they're called, and we're sort of a little different from those. And we see those as the important big buyers at first to help get this marketplace off the ground. It's a really tricky task to set up and stand up a two-sided marketplace where we have these suppliers and buyers who have neither one of which has ever worked through us before. And so we need to make sure that we have enough of both as we get things going. Now, as we move into the future and we've established a working marketplace where buyers are purchasing carbon removal certificates, suppliers are signing up, we're getting more and more of them, we're getting new methodologies signed up on the platform, so new ways of removing carbon dioxide, we want to move into a situation where more and more smaller buyers are purchasing these. We want to make this available to anyone, any individual, any organization, a small community group, a public utility, anyone who might want to purchase these certificates, and try to find ways to embed these into everyday life. Imagine if you are pulling up to the gas station with your car and you fill up your gas tank, and at the end of the fill up, it asks if you want this gas tank to be made carbon neutral by purchasing these carbon removal certificates, and you just select yes, and then it charges you, and then in the background everything is routed through our system, purchases the certificates, and you'd be able to go online and look and see like what you purchased and what that tied to. So we see a real future of being able to scale this through embedding this in everyday life. That's really where like the difference is, the difference starts to be made in terms of impacting carbon atmospheric concentrations.
So walk us through how a consumer pumping gas, if they signed up for carbon removal on that tank, would actually be somehow removing carbon from the atmosphere. I mean, they'd still be emitting carbon dioxide from their gas-guzzling vehicle, of course, but how would this work in the NORI platform?
Sure. I want to address one thing that you just said, which is that they'd still be emitting. And NORI takes the philosophy that we treat carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions like a waste product. Now, compare this to how we deal with garbage and waste in our cities today. No one is advocating that we should live in a garbage-free society. We've instead chosen to collectively collect our waste, recycle as much as we can out of it, and then store what we can't as responsibly as possible. And we're proposing doing the same thing with our carbon dioxide. We don't take a moral position against carbon dioxide. We're trying to create this service so that people can still continue to use energy to improve human lives and increase trade and lift people out of poverty and all the other wonderful and amazing things that energy has done for the overall human condition. So there are many different ways that people can remove carbon dioxide. And I was sort of surprised when I started looking into this about 3 years ago, the number of different methodologies that could do this and how large of an impact they could potentially make.
What are some of the solutions that make you most optimistic, Paul?
The first and biggest one that could make the most impact is the first methodology that we're going to include on our platform, and that's soil carbon removal. So this is agriculture-based. Many people don't know that a large percentage of the global carbon dioxide emissions are actually from what's called land use change. So this one example of that could be large-scale farming, where the farms are tilling the soil and stirring up that topsoil, which releases a lot of the CO2 that's trapped in that top layer, anywhere from 20 to 48 or 20 to 50 centimeters down. There's a lot of carbon dioxide in there, and that process can actually be reversed through changing agricultural practices. If you stop using as much fertilizer and you till less and you use cover crops on your soil, so that would be leaving small crops growing in there during your off season when you're not harvesting your main cash crop, and you rotate crops around. You could do other things like managed grazing. So if you're a cattle rancher and you're moving your cattle around from paddock to paddock and managing how they graze in different areas, these practices can add up to a significant difference. And studies have shown that if we were to look at all of the cropland available in the United States, we could sequester over 1 billion tons of CO2 every single year. And to put that in perspective, globally, we emit around 35 to 40 billion tons of CO2. It's about 50 if you include other greenhouse gases. So it's about 50 billion tons every year going up into the atmosphere. About half of that gets included in the carbon cycle, and it gets stored in oceans and rocks and soil and so on. And we believe that it's anywhere from 1 to 1.5 trillion, with a T, tons of CO2 that need to be removed from the atmosphere in order to restore the atmospheric carbon concentrations back to around 300 parts per million, which is what it was at prior to the start of the Industrial Revolution. So 1 billion tons a year just in soils in just the United States alone, that's not looking at the rest of the world, that's actually pretty significant. That's a measurable difference. So that's the first methodology that we're working with different farmers and different verifiers to develop the rules around how we measure that and getting that supply and inventory available to go when we launch our marketplace.
She's got a cigarette on each arm. She's got the lily white cavity crazes. She's got a carburetor tied to the moon. Her fingers looking to the fruit of the ages. She's alone in the new illusion. She's alone in the new illusion. Got a hand on the wheel of fate. She can talk to the strangers, she can sleep in a fiery bomb, though it tumbles to the dying embers. She's alone in the new revolution. She's
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Paul Gamble. He's the co-founder and CEO of Nori. So, Paul, just to give us some more context, so you're a voluntary carbon market.
That's right.
But this whole sector, just in 2016, accounted for only 18.5 million tons of CO2 equivalent offset.
In the voluntary, yeah.
In the voluntary space. It's still creeping along, basically. But you think using blockchain technology, it could exponentially grow similar to the way Bitcoin did. Is that a fair estimate? Or is there needs to be a lot of things in place along the supply chain to make that exponential growth kick in?
It's a bit of both. Part of the reason that those voluntary purchases are so small is because the way that the current markets are structured. If you look at the voluntary markets, and it's less than 20 million tons purchased. But if you look at the compliance markets, it's much, much higher. And it's sort of difficult to get an exact number because these markets are different. But it's closer to the range of hundreds of millions, if not in the billions. And one of the key differences between us and these other markets is that in our marketplace, it will be very clear to all parties involved that every single certificate represents one actual ton of CO2 removed, and that will be an auditable and traceable transaction. In the other markets, particularly in the compliance markets, it's sort of a not very much talked about issue that the credits that are issued often do not actually represent one ton of CO2 removed. That's because of the accounting methods that are used during these transactions, and because they're slightly more complicated. The first difference is that we're only dealing with carbon removal, whereas the other markets are dealing with avoided carbon as well. Mm-hmm. So if you are building a wind farm or a dairy digester or something like that, you're still emitting carbon dioxide, but you're getting credits for not emitting as much as you would have otherwise, even though you don't necessarily have to prove that. It's sort of assumed that if you build a wind farm that you're just, by definition, avoiding the equivalent energy production's use, as opposed to building like a natural gas plant or something like that. The other issue is that in the cap and trade market, so cap and trade is a system. California has the largest market in North America doing this. There's an equivalent thing happening over in Europe and the EU. In the cap and trade market, the way that it works is the government sets a ceiling of how many tons of greenhouse gases an emitter is allowed to produce every year. In California, that includes companies that are manufacturing companies, transportation companies, energy production companies, that sort of thing. So very industrial sort of stuff. And they're given what are called allowances, and these allowances say you're allowed to emit this many. Let's say you're an energy production company, and you're allowed to emit 100 tons of greenhouse gas per year. If you only emit 80, then that difference of 20 allowances, you're now allowed to go sell in their cap and trade marketplace. Now, if you are a purchaser of those allowances, because say you emitted 120 tons of greenhouse gas in the year, now that brings you back down to your mandated ceiling, and you've purchased those allowances from someone who didn't emit those. Now, the state would calculate both of those, both the 20 allowances sold and the 20 allowances purchased, as avoided emissions. That means that they're double counted. The participants in these marketplaces know that this is the case, and they're smart business people. They know what these credits are actually worth, not what they purport to be worth. And so they discount them when they purchase them. So we see transaction prices happening anywhere from $10 to $15. But in reality, the buyers of these and the suppliers of these know that it's really not happening at that much. And then the other thing is that there are lots and lots of middlemen interacting between these sellers of these offsets or allowances and the buyers of these.
Would you be considered a middleman? Would Nori be considered a middleman, or are you just the platform?
We're sort of a middleman to end all middlemen. We're a platform that people can come and transact on, and we will have our own measurement and verification processes, and we'll be working with independent third-party verifiers to do that verification.
He's the CEO of Nori. It's the world's only carbon dioxide removal marketplace, Paul Gamble. Paul, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks a lot, Alex. That was fun.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by Jackie Francis. She's the executive director of the Keeling Curve Prize. Jackie, welcome to SeaChange Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
So what is the Keeling Curve, and then explain why you've decided to have a prize named after the Keeling Curve.
So the Keeling Curve is a data set, and it was started in 1958 by a man named Charles David Keeling, who convinced somebody that he needed to measure CO2 in the atmosphere, and they built a station on Mauna Loa in Hawaii to start measuring carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And ever since they started this data set in 1958, it's been tracking upward. So I believe in 1958, it was at 280 parts per million, and now it's at 415 parts per million average. So for me, this is the most recognized kind of identifier of climate change and global warming, what's going on in the atmosphere. So as I was finishing a master's degree in energy policy and climate science, I decided that we have solutions all over the world, and we need some excitement about implementing and activating these solutions in order to solve this problem that we're facing. So the Keeling Curve, to me, was a great indicator of what we're looking at and how we want to try and bring that curve downward. So that's why I named it the Keeling Curve Prize.
Let's go through some of the recent winners from this past year. First, why don't you explain the categories that you try to break things down into?
So we have five categories, and we pick two winners in each category. And the winners receive $25,000 apiece, and they also get the prestige of the prize and the visibility and the accolades. So our categories are energy, finance, capture and utilization, transportation and mobility, and social and cultural pathways.
Let's start with finance. That's something that people might glaze over when they hear about clean energy, but when you think about all of the different funding strategies that need to go in place for somebody who has a good idea or somebody who's just trying to do the right thing for the environment, finance and access to capital is so essential. So who won in the finance category this year, Jackie?
Well, there's a great organization in the San Francisco area called CalCEF, and they've changed their name to the New Energy Nexus. And they've created something called the Clean Energy Opportunity Zone Fund. So it's a place you can figure out how to invest in this space.
And so if you were a startup and you needed finance for your clean energy efforts, would you go to New Energy Nexus? Are they kind of like an incubator for clean energy businesses, or is it more on a micro lending level like a Kiva?
I think they work pretty much like an microfinancing level, and they have a great network out there in the San Francisco area, so that they'd be a really fantastic person if you were in the space of trying to find money for your new organization to connect with.
And now let's look at the social and cultural pathways category. There's an organization called Science-Based Targets, SBT. What are they all about?
So science-based targets actually applied in both the finance and the social and cultural pathways categories. And sometimes you can apply in two different categories, and we'll kind of decide where we can give you the best chance, the best opportunity. And science-based targets ended up winning in this category because they really stood out as somebody that's working with corporations to identify how these corporations can set emissions targets and then how they can reach those targets. And they use an incredibly fantastic system of science verification and a great methodology to get corporations to achieve their goals.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Jackie Francis. She is the executive director of the Keeling Curve Prize. So, Jackie, let's turn to an organization that won in the capture and utilization segment of the 2019 prize, Opus 12. Its moniker is A Profitable Solution to Carbon Emissions. What are the solutions they're offering?
Opus 12 uses CO2 to create products, and they can then use these products from the polymers that they create in all kinds of anything that you would use plastic for, and they can also create biofuels.
And alongside Opus 12 in the capture and utilization category, Jackie, was Wild Coast, a Mexican company, or is this a nonprofit?
Wild Coast is a nonprofit, and what I want to point out in the capture and utilization category is that we award to both high-tech and low-tech, and Wild Coast is considered a low-tech solution because they are reforesting mangrove. Wait, I didn't say that right. Wild Coast is a low-tech solution because they're working on mangrove restoration, and they won for a project that they're doing off the coast of Baja down in Mexico. That's a refuge for animals because they're replanting the mangrove forest.
So you're now accepting applications for the 2020 prize. When will we know who are the 2020 winners? And I forgot to ask, what do the prize winners get?
So in the five categories, we have two winners in each category. So that's 10 winners altogether, and they receive $25,000 in prize money. And then we do our best to recognize and give visibility to these winners as well.
And when will the application periods end? And when are you going to announce the 2020 winners?
The application period ends on February 10th. However, we are going to cut it off at 300 applicants, and we're already getting quite a few through the door, so people should get their applications in as soon as possible. There is a potential that we might allow for more applications, but to be sure, I get an application in as soon as possible. And we then go through the analyst phase, which takes a few months, and we're going to be announcing the winners right about Earth Day, I think April 23rd, and we're looking at doing it at the Smithsonian's Earth Optimism Summit.
The executive director of the Keeling Curve Prize, Jackie Francis. Jackie, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. That was great.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimmy Smith and Beck. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.